This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're going to spend the rest of the program today listening back to my October conversation with Nikki Usher, whom we heard from earlier in the show. Before she became a professor of journalism, she was a working journalist. As a newbie at the Philadelphia Inquirer, she was assigned to cover the hinterlands, the suburbs of southern New Jersey. She writes that she longed to work at the paper's downtown building, an Art Deco palace known locally as the Tower of Truth. But it was not to be. Instead, she left for a career in academia, and eventually the Inquirer left the Tower for a single floor in another historic building, which frankly is better digs than a lot of other papers have gotten. But all of this, the importance of the Tower, the symbolism of leaving the Tower, were lessons in the power of place in journalism. Now Usher is exploring those ideas at book length. It's called News for the Rich, White, and Blue: How Place and Power Distort American Journalism. Nikki, I've already welcomed you once, so I'll just say thank you for staying with us for the rest of the show.
More than happy to be here.
So there's an old truism in journalism that reporters are out to communicate the who, what, when, where, and why of events. And you argue journalists have really messed up the where. How so?
Well, so often journalists are disconnected, even from the communities that they reside in. They're not necessarily from there. They're looking, like we were talking about just before, to move out, but move out and up, right? So there's an extractive nature. But increasingly, as we see the economic foundations of the news industry, particularly newspapers, collapse, the news organizations that are most likely to succeed are those with large national audiences, and those are located on the coast, right, New York and in D.C. particularly. And so what that means is that journalists are actually physically further and further away from the people that they're going to cover. And so that creates a real problem, a real sense of distance. But that distance is also metaphorical too, right? So there's a cultural distance. So journalists, we want our journalists to be educated, right? So it's great that journalists, 90% of journalists have college degrees, but the vast majority of Americans do not, right? 25%, only 25% of Americans have college degrees. So these gulfs in terms of class, increasingly journalists are white in a multiracial democracy, all of these things are contributing to a disconnection between the public and the people producing the news about them, not for them.
And I want to come back to you. You've hit on a lot of ideas in the book there about the digital winners and losers in the new media economy, as well as who is making the news and who the news is made for. I want to put pins in those ideas for now, though, and stick with this idea of place. And can you talk about how, in your conception here, the idea of place is not just a spot on the map as it relates to journalism?
Yeah, so place is first a spot on the map, but place is also where you are, the kind of situation and context for your social relations and how things unfold. And then place is also a function of power, right? So when you know, that Hamilton line, like wanting to be in the room, right? The room where it happens, people who get to be in and out of those rooms. And news organizations have traditionally been impenetrable fortresses, places people cannot go, right? And unless you're a journalist and you have special means of entry. So place is more than just about a geographic location. It's a sense of identity, a sense of belonging. And when we start to lose the news, or we start to see these disconnections between people telling stories about places and the people actually experiencing those places, we lose more than just information. We lose a sense of cultural rooting.
Yeah, and journalism helps people sort of understand their place, right? In the broadest sense, right? What does it mean to live in Champaign, Urbana? What does it mean to live in Rockford, Peoria, Bloomington, Springfield, right? Journalism plays a key role in that, or it did anyway.
Well, so the reason that we have news in the first place is that we as individuals do not have the time to pay attention to all of the things going on in our external environment. So journalists do a good job of sorting out what's important and giving us information beyond our own immediate experiences. So every time you listen or watch or read the news, you're engaging in sort of almost an interpersonal dialogue between where you are at this moment and what the world around you looks like. And that's, I think, really it's about identity. It's about one's relation to the greater world. And seeing yourself mirrored in that content, I think, helps become part of that larger democratic discourse and connections. So this idea that we're bound together as a nation because we believe in a certain understanding of democracy, which is facilitated through kind of just a belief that, you know, people care, and they establish that care through engaging in news, particularly at the local level.
So now we've established the importance of place, and we've talked about how news kind of serves and helps unite and knit together places, maybe. Let's talk about how news is failing, though, in those places. And I want to begin by asking you, what is a Goldilocks newspaper?
So I took the metaphor of Goldilocks because of the children's story about, you know, not too hot, not too warm, just kind of the lukewarm porridge that the baby bear wants. And so I don't want to kind of call these lukewarm porridge newspapers, but I do want to say that there's a certain size of news organization that is particularly affected. So the Chicago Tribune, I think, is like the archetype of this, right? It's not large enough to be a national news organization. It's not geographically distinct to be one of these hyper-local community newspapers that might well survive on the grit of a small town community that believes in journalism, right? So it's just at the right size to be squeezed by these really messed up logics of the way that money gets made online on digital content economics. So those favor very definable audiences or huge scale. And unfortunately, those Goldilocks newspapers don't have that scale digitally. There's also a limited, there's a tapping out of how many people have ever really subscribed to a newspaper. But when you start to look at the geographical region, there are just only so many people that are going to pay for a digital subscription to a newspaper. So they're squeezed kind of on all fronts. They're not big enough and they're not small enough.
Are there other Goldilocks newspapers in Illinois or in the region, Sun-Times? Or do you even, I mean, with the Register Star, maybe back in the day, the Pantograph, newspapers like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you're talking about a newspaper really between 50,000 circulation and up, right? So 50,000 circulation to newspapers like the Philadelphia Inquirer, which were something more like 500,000 circulation. That's kind of a broad range, but it also speaks to a particular size of city. And so, you know, the population of Peoria hasn't radically changed, but the number of journalists covering Peoria has radically changed. A once very vibrant newsroom has really declined. And that's problematic not because of necessarily just the information-seeking behaviors, but because of what newspapers are able to do for communities. So they're able to engage in editorial campaigns to improve the downtown or keep busing or whatever it might be, and act as an advocate for the community as a coherent center. And I think that that sort of role of articulating community needs can kind of get lost in the conversation about people and democracy, which is important, no doubt. But I think, you know, that is something we really need to be talking about, is that cultural leadership. But yes, I think we have many in the state once you think about that range.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, we are listening back to my October conversation with Nikki Usher, professor of journalism at the University of Illinois and author of News for the Rich, White, and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism. Because this is on tape, we're not taking calls for this segment, but we will be hearing from some callers who did phone in when our show was originally broadcast a few months ago. Peter is on the line. He's got a great question, and I think it fits into this next part of the conversation I want to talk to you about. So I'm going to ask Peter to hold on for one second. Let's talk about the title of your book, News for the Rich, White, and Blue. And maybe we can take those one by one. When you say news today is increasingly for the rich, what do you mean by that?
Well, so increasingly the quality news that's available is news you have to pay for. And it's, I mean, that's right. You want people to pay for news, but increasingly people are being left out. So if you go on to the News and Observer in North Carolina, you're immediately hit with a paywall, right? And that's the best news in that region, right? And so only the people that are willing to pay and have the cultural capital to know that it's important will get the sort of highest quality kind of newspaper journalism that we want everybody to have, rather than this much reduced version that they might pick up on 2 minutes of local television news. So I think that's sort of what I mean by rich, but I think I don't want to lose sight of the fact that news is also made by the rich. And I don't want to say all journalists are rich, because some are very much scraping by, but it's a certain kind of cultural capital that journalists bring with them when they walk into a room. And the increasingly in these big newsrooms that are most likely to survive, you don't see people who have the same experiences as most Americans. So there are a lot of Ivy League graduates. Again, we want our journalists to be smart and educated, but that reflects a particular and unique perspective on what matters in American life.
And you've talked about having students from lower income backgrounds in the past who have said, essentially, I can't afford to go into journalism, so I'm going to take this other opportunity in finance or law or whatever it would be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the pipeline, we don't love to talk about pipeline because it's too easy to focus on, you know, we fix the entry point, we don't fix the structure. But in this case, the pipeline isn't even started because students don't have the money to go to a big city and rent a room to work at that fancy internship that's going to get them flagged for a journalism job that might actually pay well, right? Because not all journalism jobs are horribly paid, right? And so they're not in a position to create the best resumes for themselves. And they don't, because journalism is an increasingly fragile industry where you can't be guaranteed a job, right? You can't be guaranteed that same job. Kids who don't have a safety net really can't make the choice to go into a job that they don't have a backup if they lose their job, right? Paycheck to paycheck. And that's really problematic because more than ever, we actually need those voices in journalism.
All right, I want to bring Peter into the conversation now. Peter from Urbana. Peter, thank you for calling in.
Right. Thank you for the opportunity to I want to share an idea with you. And I think it factors in. Maybe there's a new book that you could write, news for the poor, the black, and something, and I don't know what else. But there would be here's what I propose, that Champaign County and the cities and villages, whatever, would create an opportunity for anybody who wanted to read the News Gazette. They could do that. In other words, they would. It would be a way of increasing circulation, and it would be a way of having, on a foundational level, access to information, access to the pains, the struggles, the problems, and the successes, and whatever that is foundational to creating a healthy, vibrant, caring community.
So it sounds like, Peter, if I can sum up, maybe public funding is what you're suggesting for
yes,
news.
That the municipalities would fund the newspapers, and or buy subscriptions as wanted, and then once that happens, then their circulation would increase, and they would benefit from having extra revenues from advertising, which is, I guess, how the newspapers make their money.
Sure. All right, Peter. Thank you for calling in. Let me ask Nikki to respond to that. Nikki, I'll stand here and wave my hand for public broadcasting, but beyond that, what about public funding?
So, you know, public funding, public broadcasting, that definitely has to be one of the pillars for community news and information. There are some states that have actually purchased mass subscriptions for their libraries, for their digital. So Californians can get the New York Times for free at the library electronically. And even here on campus, students' programming fees actually play for digital subscriptions. So there are ways in which subsidies exist that are actually more hidden than you might think. I kind of depart from a lot of the pack in that I am very concerned about reliance on public funding. It might work in some places, right? And it might not work in others. One of the things I worry about is you don't bite the hand that feeds you, right? And so that's kind of the situation that you get into when you have municipally funded news and information. There are, though, especially, right, and again, this is a function of some communities are better resourced than others. We have an indie media center here in Champaign, and many of those, there were flickers, and they kind of disappeared, but we still have one. There's also public access television and public access radio that gives people the chance to create journalism, and I think that's underused. So I am not a big proponent of this whole bite the hand. I just worry about that accountability function when you start to have public funding. And just as what's given, it can be easily taken away. And if we think about the last 4 years under the Trump administration, you can see what it might be like to have too much government interference in the news media. Mm. Or suddenly having that yanked away. Yeah. So I worry about that. There has to be a multi-pronged plan.
I think it's in your book that I read the anecdote about the Florida community that didn't want to pay for the New York Times, the fake news New York Times, right, for their library. We need to take a break. We are going to continue my October conversation with Nikki Usher, professor of journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and author of the book News for the Rich, White, and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism. And I do want to mention a quick programming note. This is our last sort of encore or repeat broadcast of the holiday season. We plan to be back with a live show tomorrow, looking back 1 year since the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol in Washington. We would love to hear what you think about that, how you thought about it then, what you think now that a year has gone by. Send us a voice memo. You can leave a voicemail for us at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Or email us. All the ways to contact us, it's all on our website, 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. More to come with Nikki Usher after a quick break. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're going to continue my conversation from October with Nikki Usher, professor of journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the author, most recently, of News for the Rich, White, and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism. Because the show is on tape, we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you thought by sending us an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address, talk@21stshow.org. Okay, here now is the conclusion of my conversation from October with Nikki Usher. Nikki, I think I'm going to, just for the sake of time, I'm going to skip over the white part. We had a conversation on Monday with journalists from Black and Latino-focused news organizations who talked about the many ways through history, through now, that, you know, so-called mainstream media does not well serve communities of color. And tomorrow we'll be talking about diversity and inclusion in journalism schools. So I'm going to set that aside and talk about the blue. When I've talked to people about this part of the title of your book, this is where I hear the most resistance. They say, "Has she ever heard of Fox News or Facebook or AM talk radio, yada, yada, yada." But I want to play a little tape to get into this part of the conversation. And this goes back to 2004. It's a campaign ad that was run against Howard Dean, then the governor of Vermont, who was unexpectedly competitive in the Democratic presidential primary.
Well, I think Howard Dean should take his tax hiking, government expanding, latte drinking sushi eating, Volvo driving, New York Times reading,
body piercing, Hollywood loving, left wing freak show back to Vermont where it belongs.
New York Times reading, the horror. Nikki, how does that description fit with what you mean when you say news is increasingly for the blue?
So I think that that's a perfect example. I want to steal it and use it for my classes. But
I'll send you the link.
Yeah, no, I want to be really clear that when I say the blue, I don't mean the institutional news media, because I actually think that the institutional news media reinforces the status quo at best. And certainly we have a very strong right-wing partisan media. So I don't want people to kind of get confused about that. What I'm really referring to the fact is that the October 2021 Gallup poll for trust in news media, 11% of Republicans trust the news media. 68% of Democrats trust the news media. And that gap, that is the gap I'm speaking to. Because if you trust the news media and you believe it is important in your community and to the world at large, you're more likely to pay for it. And if you don't trust it, you're just more likely to tune out. So that's really what I'm speaking to. This asymmetrical polarization, what we call it in the academy, in trust in news.
Right. And let's listen to another piece of tape on this that I wonder if you think is part of the story. I'll say I do. This is a television ad from last year. There's no narration. It's a soundscape with images, but I think we can get the gist of what it's about from listening.
I got a very, very small loan from my father.
You've got to start somewhere.
I'm a reporter from the New York Times.
I'm aware of bank statements, tax returns, thousands of property records, deeds, and mortgages.
1995 showed that he was bleeding money.
Go through it all, understand it all.
Holy
number by number, brick by brick.
That's when we realized
that's fraud.
I built this empire. I did it by myself.
Okay, Nikki, is that a Democratic campaign ad or an ad for the New York Times? And what does it say that it maybe is not obvious what the difference is?
Can I go with B, ad for the New York Times? I feel like that strangely resembles its Truth campaign, but the fact
it
that...
It is from the Truth campaign,
yes,
indeed.
Yes,
yes.
Bonus points. I think that, that... What the New York Times is expressing there is, holding the powerful to account, which should be the case for whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in Congress. But the New York Times marketing folks who are putting together this very brilliant Truth campaign know who their audience is, right? And their audience wants to see, especially at that time, nothing more than Donald Trump brought down. So I think that it's a very deliberate play, right? It's the marketing to people who are most likely to subscribe to the New York Times. And I don't think it does the New York Times a particularly good service in its claims that it is trying to provide neutral, objective journalism, which has been kind of the default response of that newspaper during the entire kind of Trump administration and into the present.
And you say that this journalism, it's important for a healthy democracy, and yet it's also more undemocratic, small d democratic. I think it would be facile to take the title of your book and just say, okay, news should be for the poor, non-white, and conservative. So who should the news be for? How should we be thinking about it?
I mean, I think the news should be for everybody, right? I mean, that's the spirit that public broadcasting is all about, right? That the news belongs to the public, the airways belong to the public, and we need to educate, inform, and provide daily orientation to everybody, regardless of what they look like and whether or not they can pay, right? That's the promise of public media, I think.
But is there anything that's made for everyone anymore? I mean, even people point to the one media event as being universal as the Super Bowl, right? But there's still counter-programming. You have the Puppy Bowl, other things like that. Is there anything that's for everyone?
Well, I think that's the beauty, though, right, of the present situation is people have so much choice. And so it gives the opportunity for people to rise to the occasion to become real leaders in their communities and even their online Facebook groups when they become an expert in one particular thing. The problem that gets mixed in, right, is when those very niche silos get in the way of really accurate and fact-based information, and that's where it can start to get really complicated. But in general, right, a high-choice media environment where the most politically engaged can spend all their time reading about politics and the people who care most about sports can spend all their time reading about sports, I think that that's a good thing, right? I think that represents the breadth of people's interest rather than a narrow cast.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-222-9455. Tom is on the line from Springfield. Tom, thank you for calling in.
Hello.
And I understand you want to talk about independent news sites.
Yeah, specifically online independent news. You mentioned it a little bit, especially with Block Club Chicago, and I think the Midwest Independent Center for Investigative Journalism. Probably confusing the name.
No, that's right. The Midwest Center for Investigative Journalism. Yep, we talked about
those are actually two examples of what's, at least nationally, has been a growing trend of locally owned and independent news, online newspapers, basically. Though I have seen, like the professor was talking, where they're concentrated. In Illinois, there's quite a few of those kinds of publications, but they tend to be concentrated in the Chicago area.
Right.
I mean, you have Blood Club Chicago, Citizens Bureau. There's others that I'm not.
City Bureau is another one. Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, thank you for that, Tom. And Nikki, I think that's a good segue into another question your book explores, which is philanthropy going to save journalism?
So I think that the observation that was made by the listener was totally on point, that cities are so much better positioned to provide almost replacements for the decaying local news environment. Chicago is thick with journalism grads and smart people who care about their communities. And it's also really close and proximate to not just philanthropic foundations that we might associate with journalism, but other ones that we might associate with the arts and good governance. And so that proximity gives people in Chicago who are looking to do more to inform their communities just a better chance of securing that funding. When you start to break out into more rural areas, that's where it starts to get really, really complicated, because most of the funders don't really understand. They're based in cities. They're used to funding maybe a block club or, another sort of city-based kind of news outlet that's reaching a very concentrated, geographically specific audience, right? They're not used to the different needs of more non-metro communities. And because they're based in cities, kind of the expectation and setup is kind of misaligned. But also the networks, right? If you're in a big city and you're able to go to various charity events and mix and mingle, right? People who are in more rural areas don't really have that advantage. And so you're starting to really see kind of the same exact inequities that existed in commercial news media being reflected in that philanthropic news media. And my book shows that it's not that where the funding for investigative journalism is going is not aligned with places that actually need it, but it's more likely to go to blue states and from big blue cities to other big blue cities.
In the time we have remaining, I want to talk about some of the possible paths forward you suggest for the news industry. You have sort of 5 points. I don't think we'll have time to get through all of them, so I'm just going to pick a couple. One is accept the death of local news as we know it, or as we imagine it, and move toward a post-newspaper consciousness. What is a post-newspaper consciousness?
So if you can think about all of the good things that the lawmakers were talking about, right, all of those things come from newspapers, but they don't have to be newspapers, right? Are there other community organizations that can fulfill many of those same needs? We need to just sort of accept that commercial local media, especially newspaper media, is bust. And so what is it that we like most and newspaper journalists do best that we need to preserve? And maybe that's the bit that we unbundle and really try to fund. And maybe we leave the other things like community connectedness to other social institutions in a place. So it's kind of thinking past this whole save the news idea, which maybe may put me at odds with the local news task force, but we'll save that for our meetings.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. All right. You say that to remain presumptively independent is to dodge an important role. And this gets into this question of objectivity in journalism that so many hours of, I'm imagining, J-school discussions have been held on this. But you say that you know, journalism can serve as a moral guidepost in a complicated society. An independent, morally neutral journalism obfuscates rather than offers clarity. There's a lot of social science research out there, though, George Lakoff, Jonathan Haidt, and others, showing Americans have very different ideas about morality, right? The New York Times claims truth is its moral standard, and now we're in a post-truth society. How do you stake a moral claim and not alienate a significant part of your potential audience?
I think so. It's sort of the 11% of Republicans believe in mainstream media. You've already eliminated a large portion of the audience. It's never coming back. So I think there's kind of a delusion that many news organizations are operating under that even that side is even paying any attention or cares what is being said. And that is a really dark, kind of tough reality to accept. So there's a whole generational change happening in journalism right now where young journalists are not going to stand for sort of neutral, wishy-washy, we'll say whatever the police say as truth sort of stuff. And they want journalism to do something for social justice because that's the reason many of those young journalists got into this in the first place. And I think that it's honest, right? It's much more honest for a news organization to say, hey, we care about society and we care about a particular version of society. And once you start to do that, at least people know what team you're on.
And this gets to the final point I think we have time for in just about a minute left. Consider partisan news media a feature rather than a flaw of American journalism. Let me ask you, why is there no New York Times of the right? Tucker Carlson set out to do that with a Daily Caller. I don't think it's worked out that way. Why has that not come up? Sort of fact-based journalism for a conservative audience?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I would dismiss that quite as easily. I think the Washington Times is often a first read for establishment conservatives in addition to still the New York Times, right? And I think the Wall Street Journal is actually pretty decently trusted, more trusted than untrusted, according to Pew. So I'm not quite sure I would agree with you on that point. But I think that moral guidepost that right-wing media loudly provides is something that is very appealing. And the moral coherence is more important than the details.
The book is News for the Rich, White, and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism. If you want to learn more, we'll have a link on our website, 21stshow.org. Nikki Usher, thank you for making the time to share your ideas with us today on the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all we have time for today. We do plan to be back with a live show tomorrow, Thursday, marking 1 year since the insurrection among Donald Trump supporters at the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. We'd love to hear your memories of that day and what you make of the year since then. Is America in a better place now? Are we in a worse place? Leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Or you can send a voice memo or just a plain old text email to talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer, and our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.